do is talk, talk.
These are the people at the heart of racing. Their lives, their stories, in their own words.
Yeah, racing. I mean, that's where it started, Michael. That's really the beginning. That's where it burned as a kid.
We'll talk about the champion, Black Caviar.
Black Caviar was a freak. So was the trainer.
No, the first Melbourne Cup I was involved with was a horse called Gutum Gutum.
Gutum Gutum.
I was listening to an RSN interview with John Hawkes, and he said, I think it's a really average guineas this year.
This is a very sad story, but making sure that, you know, that his head was upright.
See TJ Smith or Bart Cummings in the background, and you're just in awe.
Follow a lot of sports, but the sport I'll follow most closely will be horse racing.
For the next hour, RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents Racing's Open Mic.
Yes, and on Open Mic this morning, we have Charlotte Littlefield and her husband, Julian Hay, and I've been wanting to get them in for quite some time because I reckon one of the most difficult things to do in racing in Victoria at the moment is to flourish in the era of Darren Weir and Hayes Davenigan and eke out a career. And that's exactly what Charlotte, with the assistance of her husband Julian, have been doing. So welcome to the studio, guys. Firstly to you, Charlotte. Thanks for coming in.
Hello.
And Julian.
Yeah, thanks, Matty, for having us.
Bit of an effort, actually, because I know how hard you work, Charlotte. You've got about eight balls in the air every morning and you're doing most things with the horses. And you've come from, what, Narnagoon?
Yes, we're out in the Goon, so normally it's about a two-hour trek in when it's this busy, but luckily there are still kids at school, and I think I even beat the tradies in this morning.
Yeah, it's a bit like that at this time of year, but if we did this time next week, it would take you 2 hours, so we just got lucky with the holiday crowds. So you must have got things tidied up pretty quickly this morning at the stables.
Oh, I've got a good team back at the stables, so I've got about three or four girls that work for me, and we were meant to do gallops this morning, but we've just put those back a day. We've got one racing tomorrow, so she just had a nice easy morning off the pony and got to oversee a bit of that in the mist this morning. It's quite misty this morning out there.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Foggy or misty?
A bit foggy, really. You can see much. So I tried to oversee a couple of horses working, but didn't see much, and then jumped in the car and came up here.
I think a fog is an Australian version of an English mist.
There you go. We always get a little bit misconstrued over here.
Now, Julian, when I spoke to Charlotte a couple of weeks ago, she said, oh, I'm always tired. You know, I'm working really hard and it's worth it. But, you know, it's the reward is worth it. But it's a really tough gig and I'm up early. And are you not helping her?
I'm a bit of a punching bag for her, I think.
I kept thinking, what's her husband doing?
Not a very good job, but look, we've had a good couple of months, so it's been a happy household at home. That's amazing what a few winners can do for the relationship, that's for sure.
You have had a terrific run, and we'll talk about your background that has led to the training skills that you've got that has led to your recent run of form, but you must be chuffed I know you haven't had a lot of runners lately, but your strike rate had been through the roof, and your previous 6 months with a small squad of about 12 had been fantastic, so it must be a big wipe of the brow to work so hard and get those results.
Well, I've been training for 3 years now, and we sort of just got the team exactly where we want it. And we've got 12 in work, but only five or six up and racing. So to get a 21% strike rate over that sort of period of time was just a dream come true. I mean, it's so hard, as you said before, against the likes of Darren Weir, David Hayes. And it's all about placement for our horses. And yeah, occasionally we love to shoot for the stars and go to the city meets, but we've just tried to place our horses as best as possible, and that's worked. So,
and Julian, you come from a family of punters. You've got a law background. I imagine, because Charlotte's training seems to be very instinctive, and we're going to talk about some of the things you do, like up the bunyip hills and things like that. But I imagine there needs to be sort of a punting sort of aspect, that mindset, to even to the placement of horses and where the right place to go and things like that. Do you bring some of that to the table?
Yeah, I suppose I've from a very young age was doing the form and punting, only on in a very small way, mind you. But I suppose I do look at the races in more depth, and Charlotte probably relies on me a little bit to say if the race is too strong and how maybe we ride the horses. So we do balance each other out in that way. Charlotte's, as you say, she's an instinctive trainer, and she doesn't get too caught up in form and that type of thing. So she sort of concentrates on getting the horses fit and getting them ready to rumble. And if I can help her out a little bit with the placement, that's sort of what I try and do.
Just listeners are probably thinking, what's the story with these two? Where did they meet? I believe you met at Anzac Day at Flemington about 6 or 7 years ago. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, I just completed a uni degree and had mum out.
It was
here.
An unrelated subject, wasn't it?
Completely unrelated. I've had a few different lives in my 35 years, but I studied a business degree at Deakin, and I just graduated. Mum came over. And I took her to Flemington. It was a very cold, blustery Anzac Day, and we were about the only two females there. So he had slim pickings. but he came over and attached himself to my mum first. He did it
strategically
good way.
Sound there, Julian, strategically
very
sound.
Very strategic, but it worked. It took him a little while, but we finally went out for a date, and he promised me some pre-trainers. He was working for Jason Warren at the time, and he said to Jason, mate, I've met this English girl, and I really, really want to get to know her a bit better. He said, well, send her some pre-trainers. So
how it works? Is that the little hook in the racing dating game, is if you can get him some pre-trainers?
Oh, well.
Jace was a
when
great.
You promised Charlotte the pre-trainers before Jason suggested it, did you actually think you were able to deliver the pre-trainers, or was that just a bit of a promise on the run?
Oh, geez, I was hoping Jace would say yes, and to his credit, he said, mate, whatever it takes. If we need to send a few pre-trainers her way, then let's do it.
So there's no I in team. It's good to see that Jason Warren appreciated that.
So Jace was at the wedding, and he's still a good friend of ours, and he played his part in Charlotte and I coming together, that's for sure.
So at that stage, we're going to backtrack here in the story. We'll get to the start of it eventually, but at this stage, when you sashayed into almost a blokes only Anzac Day where Charlotte and her mum were the only two women, what were you doing at the time, Julian?
I think I had just...
You had light touch.
Yeah, I just returned from America. I'd spent a year in Kentucky and was in between jobs pretty much. And I think I was just starting at Jason's at the time and probably hadn't been there that long. So I think I was mucking out boxes at Jason's. I sort of started from the ground up down there at Mornington and did 10 months of strapper work. And Jason gave me the racing manager gig. So I think I probably led Charlotte down the garden path in making her think that I might have been an assistant trainer at the time where I was...
Sounds like there was a bit of smoke and mirrors at the beginning of this relationship. Yeah.
So
it worked, didn't it? It's okay now. We can laugh about it.
But you, going backwards with you as well, before Jason Warren and before you went to America, you came from basically a family of punters and you ventured down to the law degree path, didn't you, initially?
Yeah, look, Pop was a big punter up in Bendigo, punter and racehorse owner, and Dad followed suit. Dad was a little bit more measured in his punting than Pop was. I think Pop lost the farm due to punting and the like, but he was a well-known figure up in Bendigo. So it was in the family DNA for sure, and we lived just near Moonee Valley, and I spent my youth following Darren Gauchy around Moonee Valley and Flemington, and I remember following River Ruff and all those great horses that Gauch used to ride. So
Black Manicata, I remember Racetrack called him in 1984.
Yeah, River Ruff. Pura Pack of Plate, I think it was. But I was bitten from a very young age. So form guide was always in the hand, and had quaddies from a very young age. So
did you reveal that you were a desperate punter when you met Charlotte on Anzac Day, or was that another thing you kept from her?
Yeah, I think I'm a pretty poor punter, so I think I kept that one to myself, but I certainly probably led her down the garden path with a few little omissions, but it worked, and she got the two pre-trainers, and things very slowly developed from there.
Yeah, and you went into law.
Yeah, I studied law at Deakin, so we're both Deakin graduates. I studied law and then practiced for 6 or 7 years quite poorly, I might add, Matt. I was a property lawyer and sort of morphed into sort of corporate commercial law, but I found it pretty dry, and I think I spent more time at the law firms on BreedNet and RaceNet, and so I knew my sort of time in the law career was going to be short-lived. I couldn't see a long future in the law degree, and I got out as quickly as I could.
Did you find, I've got a brother-in-law who's a lawyer, I've got a couple of mates who are lawyers, and they're all crazy punters. Is it something that goes hand in hand with being a lawyer, that you're a mad punter?
Yeah,
or a punter? Not a mad punter, or just gravitate to the punt, lawyers?
There's a lot of lawyers that love a punt and love their racing. I think maybe it's that they've got a bit of disposable income, but there's a lot of... Charlotte's actually got a couple of clients that are lawyers and former judges, as you know, Matt. And, yeah, there's a lot out there, and they probably just need that outlet from the law, which is quite dry and all-consuming. So, yeah. For me, it was a great outlet, the racing and the punting, yeah.
And Charlotte... As Julian says, something that he did bring to the table was some clients, and Russell Lewis, Judge Russell Lewis, former Judge Russell Lewis is one of your clients. So a few of your early clients are still there, and a lot of them were brought to the table by your husband here.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's just a few have come on board, and I think the way we train has appealed to them, and obviously taking a bit of time with them. And yeah, we've got some lovely horses and some great clients, and hey, they pay the bills, so it's always helps.
Tell us about, because the most difficult thing, especially in the land of the giants with Weir and all these big stables, is cornering clients and getting the confidence of clients. You know, obviously the big trainers have these terrific wins and strike rates and the public prominence and things like that. How difficult has it been for you, as an outsider too? You came here in 2005. How difficult has it been to gather a good group of clients?
I think having Jules has really helped. I mean, we're a good team, and he brought a lot of clients to the table through friends, family. I mean, obviously we started out mainly with friends and family, and once you start doing well, you know, success breeds success. So we haven't found it too hard at this stage. Obviously, the first year we went to Magic Millions a couple of years ago for the first time. I went up there, purchased a filly for $55,000, and really put my neck on the line there. But I had a really good supporter from day one who actually got me to get my license initially. He was the owner of Bergerat Rose, my first winner.
Yep.
He was always so supportive, still is to this day, and he would always put a large chunk of money down if we purchased anything. And knowing that you had sort of a quarter or half of a horse done gave you that confidence, and then obviously promoting through Facebook, social media has been a massive help. But I am, I suppose, a little bit of a point of difference. Female trainer, fairly young. Everyone keeps saying young. I don't feel that young.
Well, I'm 49. You're young.
Okay, we'll keep going with it. The wrinkles are starting to
appear. You are so young.
Good. I'll keep going with that.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
It's just, and I suppose, being English, having an English eventing background, I've brought something new to the industry, and the way we train and the way that I try and promote myself as well, and our team, we're all females. I'm sure Zach, our farrier, won't appreciate that, but he does have long hair. So it's just a matter of trying to be as transparent with our training,
yeah.
Have it really open to everybody, how we prepare the horses, and we kill them with love. You know, these horses are so well cared for, and we're all about welfare of the horse, and you know, they either stay with us forever, or we rehome them as best as possible. So promoting the whole life of a racehorse is what we're trying to achieve.
That holistic sort of start to finish sort of,
yeah,
thing. And I'm going to ask you about Huey a bit later on, because he was part of that scene as well. But just on, I remember trainers that aren't sophisticated with social media and the ability to promote, like the younger trainers seem to be because they've grown up with that sort of technology. Going to the yearling sales, I remember they used to, some of them would end up in the fetal position in the corner afterwards because they overcommitted and they couldn't sell. They had a life of continual debt and stress. But it seems like you've been able to avoid the severity of that to some degree. And your website is amazing too. I don't know who you've got to create your website, but it's a very attractive website with lots of you know, the imagery and so on. So you've obviously nailed that one as well.
Well, I sort of had a bit of a marketing background, obviously working at Cranbourne Turf Club. So I've had a bit of experience with marketing aspects of running a business, and obviously promoting through a website is so vital. Prism did our website, and they've done a fantastic job. So I think Prism are taking over now. They're doing a lot of websites. And
oh, you should have got exclusivity things signed. Your lawyer husband could have got that contract signed up with Prism.
I keep approaching him for lawyer advice, and he fails miserably. So anyway, it's going well, the website, and it's obviously attracted a lot of clients. Just getting it out there, obviously we've had the winners, so people start looking at, and Hayfields Racing, our business name, is obviously different to my name, so we've just amalgamated our surnames.
I was thinking about that because,
yeah.
Because you're the trainer and you're the field bit of it, and you're the hay bit, but it's such a horsey connection, isn't it? You've got a little field,
yeah,
and a hay. It's just, what else could it be? And it wouldn't have sounded any good if it was Fields Hay Racing,
no,
would it?
No. But if you say Charlotte Littlefield Racing, it's a fair mouthful. So
it doesn't roll off the tongue, does it?
It doesn't. So we're just trying to find something that was a little bit easier to say. And why not? We were always, you know, I had no intention of backing out of the relationship. So we thought, well, amalgamate now. I didn't take a surname because I'd already got a bit of a profile, and I suppose it's a little bit difficult to do all the paperwork. I'm a little bit lazy on admin side.
Well, and that's hopefully where Julian comes in, and we're going to talk to Julian about some of his other projects as well. But just that evolution that we're talking about with Charlotte, about being able to promote yourself and branding is important without going over the top about it and all that sort of stuff. Have you been witness to this as it's unfolded with the stable, or part of it as it's unfolded in the last year or two?
Yeah, Charlotte's amazing on social media. She really does all the Instagram and Facebook tweets and messages. So she's a natural on social media, much better than myself. I try and keep the website up to date. So together we get most of the work done, I suppose, during the week, after hours, or working sort of up late last night, Matty, putting a few posts on the website just in case people jumped on today. So...
You mean people are listening to this?
So they say, but yeah, Charlotte's she's a very good promoter of her business, and she does it very naturally. So I don't have to do too much, which is good.
Have there been tough times, though? I remember, again, when I spoke to you for a piece I did for Winning Post, you said the last 6 months has been great, but the previous year or two had been tough, and you sort of question reward for effort a bit, don't you, sometimes? And you felt like everything was going the wrong way. And I guess as a husband and business partner and everything, Julian, you must have seen some ups and downs with your partner.
Oh, it's a tough gig, the training. The life of a trainer and Charlotte, like all the trainers, goes up and down. And there is a lot of support out there now for trainers and everyone in the industry, which is sensational. Hopefully Charlotte will never need it. But we know that, you know, a good run is not going to last forever. And we've definitely had a great run over the spring. But Charlotte's level enough to know that it's not going to last forever. And, yeah, I just try and be there to support her during those tough times. But, yeah, you doubt yourself. I see the doubt creep into Charlotte's mind when things aren't going right, and it happens with all the trainers. So,
was there ever a time over the last couple of years where it got to a decision about whether this was worth continuing on, and was it like, let's give it another 6 months, another 12 months? Did it ever get to the stage where either of you questioned whether this grand venture was the right way to go in life?
I think there was a very cold, wet July morning, and we were just about to send one of our own horses off to the races, Where's My Wallet? Now, we bred this horse. Well, we bought the mare and
foal. I'll ask you why it was called that soon.
Another great Jules story. Anyway, so we had
this down horse. The back of the couch where it always is.
Either that or the phone. Where's everything? So
what do you see in this bloke? Anyway.
So we were about to run this horse at Mornington, and I went out to the paddock. He's a horse that needed company in a paddock. As most of our horses, they're quirky, they need company, they need outdoor life. Went to the paddock that morning. It was already a tough time for us, and he had a massive knee. We had to scratch morning of the race. And I think that just culminated in a really poor couple of weeks there. And I think I did sit on the stones and just cried.
Yeah.
And I thought, why am I doing this? But I think as a sports person, you do that. You work so hard to achieve something.
Yeah.
And you think the horse is spot on to go to the races. You know, you've told everybody. It's on social media. You're excited. You've organised a whole day at the races for everyone to go. You bought lunch. And then suddenly the horse has a fat knee. And
yeah.
And it's not just a fat knee. The horse was hopping lame. He'd obviously been kicked quite badly. And Cheryl, my foreman, I called her because I was so angry at her horse. It was her horse that did it. Not her fault. Not the horse's fault.
Poor old
fault.
Cheryl's just
coughed. I know. She's coughed a few bad days. Poor Cheryl. So I think a day like that, sometimes you've got to let it all go. Then you've got to start again. If I ever get really bad, I go to sleep. I always find out if I wake up after a sleep, I'm good. So
alcohol's good too for that.
Wine also.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, we're going to talk about Cheryl too soon and your All Girl Crew. I know Cheryl's a really important partner of yours in the training when you go up the bunya pills and so on. But for now, we're going to take a break at 25 past nine because the first at the Ville at Hillsville is lurking, and it'll be brought to you after this break.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
And on Open Mic, we are talking to Charlotte Littlefield and Julian Hay, the partners. And as you may have gathered from Charlotte's lovely accent, she's a Pom and she was born in Hampshire. And we're now going to go back to the very beginning, Charlotte, of the story that has led you to where you are today. And you were born in Hampshire, and I think your mum was a bit of an equestrian, wasn't she?
Yeah, she ran a riding school in Hampshire, and then she basically said to me, "You will ride. You will be put on a pony and ride," which I'm very grateful for to this day. And that, well, graduated into me riding at Pony Club and Mounted Games, which was a great start for developing a good seat and a good position.
What's a Mounted Games?
Mounted Games is racing on ponies. So it's sort of little Gymkhana games almost, but at slightly higher level. So we did a lot of that.
What, little 9 and 10-year-old kids?
No, people still do it in their 20s.
Is that right?
It's pretty. It's a pretty full-on sport out there. So it was a great way to establish a good seat. I don't think enough people do it as younger kids now. It's sort of very...
What, on Shetland ponies?
No. They're literally little race... They're like little race horses.
Right.
So up to about 14.2, and you run very fast. You jump on them, jump off them, pick up things. You know, it's sort of a bit of a random sport, but
yeah.
A lot of people still do it, and it's, as I keep saying, it's a great way to develop a really good seat and good riding.
Is Hampshire a horsey area?
So the main area is the Cotswolds, I suppose, for eventing, and then obviously Newmarket for your racing. But Hampshire, the whole of England is very horse orientated. So
yeah.
You've got all your pony clubs. I was a member of the Petersfield Pony Club for many years, and then when we were about 15, we moved to Somerset. So that's sort of where everything continued. We bought a farm. So we rented land in Hampshire, but then we moved to a proper farm with our own acreage, 40 acres, in the Brendon Hills, which was very, very hilly country, I suppose, where my love for hill training came from.
Yeah, and you've been able to mimic that in the Bunyip Hills too. So didn't you ride at some very special international competition in Poland or somewhere?
Yeah, so I had a very good horse that I produced from a three-year-old with the help of my coach Spencer Sturmey, who comes out a lot to do commentating at Adelaide four-star event. Went to Poland, which was the Young Rider Europeans, and I rode individually, but the team won a gold medal, and I placed 15th individually, but on a seven-year-old horse at sort of three-star level. So it was a very young horse at that level, and he was an outstanding horse. He went on to be purchased by a German rider and went to badminton and Le Moulin four stars.
Are they worth a squillion, those? I remember... This will sound ridiculous. I remember watching a James Bond movie where one of the scenes was in this equestrian place in France.
I love that movie.
Yeah, and it was like the horses were living in a castle, and I thought, oh, this must be a fancy racing stable, but it was either a polo or an equestrian stable.
Yes.
It's a very lavish sport, isn't it, the equestrian in Europe?
Yeah, in England in particular, it is. And I suppose that's why I ended up out here, because my parents got to point where they said, okay, you need to go and find sponsorship. We can't keep bankrolling you. So I went and worked full time and tried to juggle the horses around, tried to get sponsorship really hard over there. I only had the two horses at elite level or top level, and producing young horses was what I did, but I always had to sell them to make money to keep sustaining
What's
it.
What's a good one worth?
Oh, my good horse was sold for about probably $120,000 to Germany. He was top
Do they
class.
Win prize money or status and ribbons?
You can at top level, but geez, you got to have good backers in that industry over there. It's the same over here. You know, you ride at top level, you've got to have really good support behind you. It's a bit more accessible over here for equestrian. It's not so elitist, and I love that. I love the fact that anyone can have a go over here. But the good riders tend to go to Europe, because that's where it all centres around.
Julian, before you met Charlotte, did you really know what the national hunt was in England, or did you sort of half know what it was?
I'm learning things now. I didn't know Charlotte was so into mounted games, and I certainly didn't know about national hunt and all those pursuits that she did in Hampshire. So, no, I was a little bit naive in that respect. I just knew racing, and that was about it.
Because we were at the back before, and the next stage of your life was the national hunt, and I was saying to Ben, I said, is that the same as jumps racing over there? I think it's kind of is, yeah. It's
yeah, National Hunt is jumps racing.
Oh, well, there you go.
There you
I told you it was jumps racing, you know.
That's all right.
So you went and this is an important chapter of your life, because it sort of relates to the way you train your horses now a little bit too. And I remember you told a lovely story about how you used to train them through the alleyways and all this sort of stuff, and then up a hill, but it was also used for pheasant shooting, and you never knew whether a pheasant was going to leap out your path. Tell us about the national hunt.
Okay, so I was eventing full-time. I needed money, so I went and worked for a very small national hunt point-to-point yard. So point-to-pointing is the amateur jumps racing scene. Very good fun. Huge scene over in the UK. And I worked for this small trainer called Tigger Day, and she was just down the road from me, and she had a small team of horses. So the way she trained was very unique. She actually worked them 4 days a week round the roads, just walking and trotting for an hour and a half. And geez,
village roads or sort of back roads? Or?
Yeah, just around the little place called Brompton Ralph in near Taunton. And it was mind-numbing. I did two a morning, so that was 3 hours in the saddle. I had to wear really padded undies because you just wore holes in your ass, really. It was terrible.
That'll
work.
Be a grab that we can play next week.
Oh, great. So we did that, and then two mornings a week we'd go up to the Brendon Hill. There was a disused airstrip. And they still kept it for light aircraft, just for landing up there every now and again. I mean, it was seldom used. We used to go up early in the morning with the mists. It was always very very romantic and cold up there, but it was lovely. I remember it fondly. And we used to do three up the side, which was up the hill, in a slow bowling canter. And then there was no timings at Tigger's Yard. It was, and then one up the centre as fast as you can go, and mind the pheasants. And you'd sort of go two abreast.
And the pheasant shooters or just the pheasants?
Just the pheasants. It belonged to a very wealthy guy who used to get the sheiks over for pheasant shoots. And, geez, these pheasants, they were not born with brains. So you'd be galloping full pelt thinking it's got to move, it's got to move. And it would only move when you were right on top of it. So then you have to try
and avoid. Particularly stupid bird.
Very stupid bird. And the cause of many accidents. I remember Robert one day... Tigger's husband, he came off quite nastily at a full gallop because this bird got entwined in the horse's feet. So anyway, it was a good way to learn to sit on at a fast gallop.
Exactly. So this is all honing your skills as a rider. And you, something else that, because I didn't grow up next to a race course, but I grew up in a town that had a race course. And Julian, did you grow up in Bendigo? Is that right?
No, I grew up in Essendon, so it was about a 5-minute walk to the valley.
And you were a 5-minute, when you were a kid, this is just backtracking a bit, another thing about your love of horse racing. Didn't you grow up right next to Goodwood Racecourse?
Yeah, so my dad lived in Midhurst, which was very close to Goodwood. And we used to go up on their twilight race meets. And all I can remember is I was given £1 to put on every race, and I used to go and put it on a horse. I wouldn't know if my horse was winning or not, but I used to scream and jump up and down. I got so excited when the thunder of the hooves going past, and can still remember that feeling now. And from the age of about 3 or 4 onwards till I was about 10 or 11, we used to go every summer and a couple of race meets each year, and it was just such fond memories. I loved it there. Beautiful track.
Julian, I was the same. When I was a kid, the races were this wonder thing of wonder, and I always think when we promote horse racing, we don't promote the wonder of the horse enough, because they are just this. I go just to look at them. I used to go just to look at the horses, and I imagine growing up in Essendon, when you were a kid, you used to toddle off to Moonee Valley and have a look at the horses when you were a kid, just for the sake of the horse.
Oh, I used to go down there by myself as a 8-9-year-old and scale the back fence at the valley and get into the betting ring and be out the back with the horses, and yeah, that's where my love grew from as well, Matty. Just being in there and right in the thick of things. So once you've got the bug, it generally sticks around.
You got the travel bug, Charlotte, didn't you, in about 2005?
It was sort of forced upon me. The good horse was sold to a German rider, so I thought now's a good time. I met an Australian guy in Taunton, of all places. I don't know how he ended up in Taunton. Came over here with him. We actually went around Europe in a camper van first, which was a new experience. But
good relationship tester too.
Yeah, it was. It was a very small camper van, but we survived. I then did a bit of Asia and then came over to Adelaide and started my Australian campaign in Adelaide, and didn't last long. So found Melbourne was the place I wanted. It was either Sydney or Melbourne, and we just so happened to come to Melbourne for New Year instead of going to Sydney for New Year as a last-minute change. And I had my heart set on going to Sydney, but thank God I came to Melbourne first.
Oh, you pulled the right rein. You absolutely pulled the right rein. And you had as well as doing the uni course, and you were probably, Julian, at roughly at uni at a similar time. Are you guys roughly the same age?
No. Jeez, that's not good. I must look old.
I must look young. Yeah, I was about...
He's 40 now.
Yeah, I was there late 90s, early 2000s at Deakin, and Charlotte must have been there when Charlotte was...
Well, I was a mature student. I went as a 26-year-old. Yeah. I could not have studied at 18 or 19, so...
Too flighty.
Yeah, too flighty.
So then you worked in quick succession with a number of trainers locally here who I imagine every one of them would have put a little piece of the puzzle into how you eventually went to train yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't actually ever think I was able to become a trainer. I just, you know, it's so foreign over in England, you can't, unless you're sort of born into it or you're placed in it from an early age. So coming out here, it's very refreshing. I suppose meeting Jules, he really pushed me in that direction. It's your passion, you're good at it, you're pre-training well. So it came about through that, and haven't really looked back since then. But
yeah, the Corsons, Kenny Keys, and a few others as well.
Yeah, so after pre-training, I went to go and work for, I pre-trained for just a couple for Liv, through Gary Mudgeway. He was the instigator in getting a few horses in the stable for me. So Andrew Noblett, Leon Corstens, a few for Jason Warren. And then I ended up getting my license to train alongside Pat Trotter. So just before Pat, I also worked for Kenny Keys for a time.
And rode Rich Enough in track
work. That was my claim to fame. It was short-lived, but I loved riding him. That was one to get me out of bed. You know, if I wasn't there bang on 4 o'clock, I was not riding him. And so I made sure I was there 2 minutes to four every morning.
Yeah, and we'll talk about your training methods and the use of the tools around you, including the hills around Bunyip and so on, and even what those trainers that you work for, what they brought to the table as well. But for now, thanks to Rob Tester there, it's 14 minutes to 10. Let's get back to our guests. And Charlotte, I'm really curious about what different trainers bring to the table, and I know that you're very instinctive, and I remember talking to you a couple of weeks ago where you said you're not easily told. You prefer to do things your own way. But working for all those guys, they would have... I imagine there was a little differences in the way they prepared horses as well.
Oh, you learn a lot from everybody. So when I was working for sort of Pat Trotter, I did some pre-trainers through Pat and Michael for Robbie Griffiths, and he was very hard on his times and his track work. So that was a bit of a shock to the system. The very first ever timed, or very first day of track work for me, I rode a timed gallop on the pro ride. And I went very fast, and, you know, that was a bit of a shock to the system. Every time you weren't exact on your timings, he would be very hard on you, which was great. Good way to learn. Mm. Pat was quite strong on his times, and, you know, he tried to make me work with a clock in my head rather than a beep on the helmet. And then
how hard is it to develop the clock in the head type rhythm?
I find it really hard. Mm. I have to ride with a beeper still because I concentrate so much on the horse's breathing and its rhythm that I end up going sort of one and then can't keep going. I try and count alligators and then get lost. So you sort of trying to teach yourself to count in a second in your head is quite hard work. So because I don't do a lot of gallops, I'll do maybe two or three a morning on fast work, then it's easier to ride with a beeper.
Yeah. So tell us about, you've got this property now and it seems to be set up really well, but it seems to be in such a great location as well. Jules, it was a former quarter horse place, was it?
Yeah, former quarter horse place. That's 100 acres in total. Probably half of it is set up for the horses or the racehorse, and we've got some big spelling paddocks out the back where we cut hay, run a few cattle, and also put the horses out in 25-acre paddocks. So, look, it's a little bit run down, but it's sort of rustic, and we've made it work, and we've built our own track there. It's like a deep dirt track, I suppose, but it's a really good workout for the horses. But between training and my job up at Caulfield, we sort of get home and do harrowing and do all the farm work. So there's plenty to be done out in a 100-acre farm, that's for sure.
I'll get back to the farm and the train. Just quickly tell us about what you're doing up at Caulfield.
Yeah, so I manage a syndication company called Carbine Thoroughbreds, and that's probably 85% of my time, and I help Johnny Sadler out and Rob Hickman out as well with some of their racing manager duties. But Carbine's a big gig for me, and we've had a good run of late with Super Hard, with Weary. He won four races over the spring, and Miss Norway is flying for Johnny Sadler. So I manage all those horses and go to the sales and buy horses and try and get owners involved in Carbine. And Charlotte's been at me to give a Carbine horse over to her, so that's probably something we'll look at in the next couple of months, which will be fun.
I have a feeling that that will be an essential thing to do, just quietly. So I was... It's such so interesting that the things you used to do are the things you do now, even though that was back with the hunt. And those, tell us about the average week and the tools that you use. And I know that you use the hills around you and things like that. Tell us about some of the secrets about how you're maximising these horses that you're training at the moment.
Well, for me, it's just getting them as conditioned to these terrains as possible. So we're starting to do a lot more road work with them again, even as young horses, just finding it's conditioning their bones a lot better. And
sounds like this is going to lead to a talk about firm tracks.
Oh. Yeah. So shin soreness is a big thing, obviously, in these young horses. We don't push them early. They tell us when they're ready. So traditionally, we don't buy young horse fast early types because we can't afford them. So we have to produce ours, you know, time in, time out, time in, time out. And the road work's helping, and we also use the hill work, obviously not for the two-year-olds, but the older horses that are a bit more conditioned, they go up to the hills. It's quite a testing little run where we go. And
so just that project in itself, like even the time required, I mean, I imagine you're only taking two up at a time. How far do you have to go, and what do you do, and what sort of a routine is it when you go up to the hills?
Well, it's a 12-minute truck ride, and we tend to try and fill a truck. So we normally take, well, we've got six horse truck. We normally take about four up there. One horse in particular really benefits from the hill is Miss Mo. She gets the luxury of going off the pony. So one of us rides the pony and she goes without a saddle and she loves it up there. And I think
is there a trail up the hill?
And it's graded. So it's sort of almost made for us because when it rained, it became quite uneven. They've just graded it recently for us again and it's absolutely perfect.
Is it for horse purposes or is it just, yeah?
It is for horse. I don't know if people know this though. And what we do is we have a driver, we drop them at the bottom, so the horses go all the way up the hill, and then they've got a short little dirt road to come down away from vehicles. It's just in the forest, and then they get picked up, so they avoid going down the road and down hills. So it's a really good little 35-minute hack. Really stimulates the horses. There's kangaroos, there's deer. So it's not just for the horses, it's for us as well. You go up there and you just smell the forest and it's just beautiful. So it is.
Do the horses benefit from that? The things that we love, like the smell of the flowers and the looking at the kangaroos, is there something about that that assists the horses mentally as well?
Have to ask them, but I mean, from the look of things, you know, they come back pretty happy. And
the change of scenery thing is, I guess, is what I'm talking about.
Well, none of them are naughty up there, you know, they can sometimes find excuses at the track. If we've got horses, we've got one in particular at the moment who's new to the stable that's been sent to us as a project, and he's quite testing.
A project with a horse sounds really bad, doesn't it?
We get a few of those, and it is good though, it's fun, it makes your life interesting. You've got to find different ways to train the horses. You know, he's the type of horse that you go one lap of the track, no problem. You try and go a second lap, no, he knows where home is and he's not going any further. So a ride like Bunyip, there's no turning back on yourself. It's just straight round, pick the horse up, off you go. And it can really turn horses around, that sort of style of training.
The physical benefit that you would have got with the pheasants back in England up that hill would have been endurance, I imagine, for those horses. But the Australian horses that you're training are sharper, I would guess, or the intention is that they're sharper. Can you maintain a sharpness in horses working up hills?
So I don't gallop up hills. I haven't found I've made them dour with the style of training that I'm using, but we do mix it up. So we don't go up the hill three, four times a week. We go up once a week, and not with all of them. It's just a tool for me to know how fit they are, and it's just a freshen up for the horse. You know, we also use the beach when we can.
Which beach do you use?
Carron Beach. Yep. Now, we used to go to Coronet Bay, and then they put restrictions in place. We used to love Balnarring, too many restrictions again. So we use Carron, and it's great to go and weigh them there if they've got any existing or pre-existing injuries. But you know, again, that's just a freshen up. It's not a tool we use every day. We find what we do at home with the arena work that builds top lines, strengthens them, makes them look where they're putting their feet, lengthens their stride with the poles.
If you can train an equestrian horse, can you train a racehorse pretty much?
Well, I haven't quite got the city win yet, but I'm going okay for now.
But
I
just generally speaking, the skills required to keep an equestrian horse sound, are they 95% of what you require for a racehorse trainer?
When I first started out, I thought I'm going to get caught in the web of training the racehorses like equestrian horses. But you know what? It works. Kieran Maher does it. He does a lot of arena work in those fundamental stages of pre-training. And I think you can use that work to educate and condition a horse in early stages. Obviously, you need other things to go with it. But it's certainly a good way of rounding a horse off in preparation.
Yeah, can it make him nimble and fleet-footed and adaptable?
Yeah, it's like aerobics for not aerobics, Pilates or yoga. Or he does aerobics now, but yeah. Anyway, it's like that. I need to do Pilates. Like, I know I'm really stiff, but I just don't have time to go do Pilates, and I'd probably want to top myself if I was sat for half an hour trying to do impossible poses. But
I tried it. There was a move called the Indian Chief, and that was the end of me. Jules, do you, as a punter, like betting on firm tracks or tracks with give?
We knew this was coming, didn't we, Charlotte?
Well, you wanted to talk about it.
I probably don't subscribe to Robbie Waterhouse's theory, but I'm not a big punter. I'm happy to bet on any surface, and Robbie's really big on soft tracks are better for horses' recovery. Charlotte and I find that a little bit... he's essentially saying hard tracks are better for recovery. I'm not sure about that. They jar up on the hard tracks. We would much prefer to have our horses on soft fives and nice cushiony surfaces like that. As for the betting turnover, well, I suppose you have to look at the statistics there.
And how punters adapt to different circumstances if it's forced upon them anyway. What's the difference between tracks here and in England?
Well, I wasn't big into my flat racing over in England. So obviously we used to race National Hunt point to point on bog tracks. So I find it quite funny here when you've got some rain and people call the races off. But then obviously safety and welfare, it's different for jumping. You need a heavy temp for jumping because it lessens the impact of any falls. But over here, I mean, we've got some horses that love a good three. We've got some horses that need a soft five. It's just about, for us, conditioning them to it. And we're lucky at Cranbourne. Cranbourne have made another grass gallop to make it more accessible for people to condition the horses on these grass surfaces. You know, we're going on sand and pro ride, and then we're racing on grass. So I think that's a lot of issue in itself.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that too. I mean, everyone loves the, and this is relates to the internationals at Werribee a little bit too, where you train on surface A because it's perfect for them at that time for that best piece of work, but how does it condition them for racing on a good three at Flemington?
Yeah, it sort of doesn't make sense, does it? You know, we're training on these sand surfaces that are quite forgiving, really, and then you go on to a good three firm grass track and, yeah, you are going to jar up because they're used to a bit of give and you've got your rollover, your turnover on the sand. So it's sort of a little bit difficult because, again, you just got a condition. That's why it's good for us at home. We do a lot of work on the grass. Around our track, we've got the deep dirt track. We've also got the firmish grass around the outside, and I don't mind doing a nice bowling canter on that harder track. And to be honest, I think it firms the tendons up anyway and conditions them better to it. So I try and get on the grass as much as possible at Cranbourne. They have got high prices, so if you haven't got an acceptor, you know, you're paying $70 for a grass gallop. If you own 10% of a horse, it doesn't matter. And I'm sure none of my owners would ever query a $70 grass gallop because they know it's for the benefit of the horse. Yeah. So I don't over gallop. If I gallop a horse, I'll try and do one gallop a week on the grass.
Fair enough. And Neil Bainbridge has been a big supporter of yours too. I wanted to mention it because I knew you would probably want to say a thank you to Neil. Just on the environment here at the moment, I know a lot of trainers who are really struggling because the dominance is so restricted to so few. And we got a really, really big trainer in Darren Weir, and he's probably the greatest trainer ever, really, when you think of where he came from to where he is. But the byproduct of that is life's difficult for others, and Hayes, Dabaniga big, and so on. As a smaller emerging trainer who's working really hard and getting the rewards, but they're not guaranteed ongoing, how difficult is it? And how we sort of touched on it earlier, is it about being so conscious of placement and strike rate and all that sort of stuff? What's the key to being successful in this current climate?
I hate the fact that strike rate is so important because it does sort of sometimes limit where you take your horses and things like that. But, for example, we've got a horse running tomorrow. And we
is that
had
Miss
two
Mo?
Options. Yeah, so Miss Mo running tomorrow. We had the option of Sandown or Kyneton. Now, she's a horse that doesn't travel that well, so we have gone a few options. We've gone to Sandown. I would have loved to have gone to Kyneton. I think that would maintain my strike rate a bit better. She would probably go there with a very good chance of winning. We go to Sandown tomorrow. With probably a lesser chance of winning, so we're probably going to make that strike rate come down. She'll run well, though. She always does. She puts 100% into every race. I haven't even looked at the form. That's Jules' job, but I don't even know if we're against any Weary or Hayes horses. So, but obviously, I think we are against a Weary horse. But, you come up against two or three in most races, and you just hope and
pray. Bit jolting, isn't it, when you see it?
Yeah. And at Kyneton, there weren't any. So that would have been the obvious choice for us as a small trainer to go there. But we've thrown the dice again, and we'll go to the city. She's ready to have a city win, whether it's lucky enough for her tomorrow. She gets it all in her go her way. She's drawn a slightly wider barrier, but look, I don't think it's that hard. I think it's the same for all of us. It is about placement, essential yeah. that you place them correctly, and I think that's why a lot of people have come to me to train their horse, because we do try and place them where they can win, and we don't mind travelling.
And you're certainly very dedicated to it. And we've run out of time, but just a very quick one, because I know that there's a couple of special staff members, but Cheryl
yes.
is one that I'm sure you'd like to make some sort of a tribute to.
Yeah, Cheryl's foreman. She works 4 days a week. She originally came on just a couple of days a week, but I've made her go more and more and more. She took over the reins from Hello My Friend and did most of the work with her in the lead up to her Jericho Cup consolation win. And look, she's just fantastic to have around. I probably couldn't do this without her at the moment, so big shout out to her. We can't do this without the staff around us.
Oh, they're going to be asking for pay rises off the back of that. hey, Charlotte and Julian, thanks for coming in. It's been, the hour's flown, so there's probably a couple of things we probably could have dealt with, but we'll do that another time. But thanks for coming in. I know it was a big drive to come in, and hopefully all the good work of recent times will be vindicated in coming months, and good luck with Miss Mo tomorrow at Sandown.
Thank you.
Good on you. Charlotte Littlefield and Julian Hay there. It's 10 o'clock, but just before we go, we've got the next winners in the Racing Pulse Picnic Bus Competition. Congratulations to Anthony Scarsella from Oakley East and Martine Simmons from Mont Albert North. You've each won a double pass to join us on the luxury coach to the Hillsville Picnic Races on Saturday, February 2nd. You'll enjoy a day of grassroots racing and invitations to the RSN 927 Marquee. We're drawing more winners tomorrow, so if you haven't entered, get your name in now on the competitions page at rsn.net.au, and you could be joining us on the Racing Pulse Picnic